Hi, this is Josh Finlay with the Texas Public Policy Foundation's National Election Protection Project. And we're coming to you live today from the Texas Policy Summit, TPPF's largest annual policy gathering. We're hosting a great guest on our podcast today, Levi Fuller, an assistant attorney general for the state of Texas. This is an interview that we're very excited about. It is not often that we get a law enforcement official to come in and talk about election integrity and what he's experienced. So Levi, it's great to have you. Can you give us an introduction?
Hi, thank you, Josh. Thank you for your time. My name is Levi Fuller. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Consumer Protection Division, Special Litigation Nonprofit Enforcement. Previously, I served on the Election Integrity Division team as a prosecutor from 2019 to 2023.
So Levi, this is so fascinating because a lot of people have concerns with election integrity, that they spot issues, but they're not prosecuted. A lot of people don't know, first of all, that the Attorney General's office has an election integrity division. So can you tell us about that a little bit, how it started and what kind of cases y'all do?
Right. So it initially started with, you know, one attorney. He was kind of working sort of part-time and he sort of pioneered this. I would call him, honestly, the godfather of election integrity in Texas. He set up an individual section in the Attorney General Ken Paxton really cares about this topic, so had full support from Ken Paxton. He set up a section, the election integrity or the election prosecution section that was under criminal law. And then down the road during one of the legislative sessions, we became our own division, the election integrity division. Essentially, this was all before Stevens, which I'm sure we'll get to. We had jurisdiction to go throughout all 254 counties in the state of Texas. And so if there was an allegation that came to us through the Secretary of State would do the initial vetting and it would come to our division and we would engage, investigate, and prosecute. But one thing I want to mention is that something that a lot of people don't know is not only did we prosecute these cases, but we carry the bulk of the investigations, I would say, in this area. We have a team of We have a team of 7 to 8 qualified investigators where this is all they do. So even on cases where we're not first chair or second chair in the courtroom, we are presenting the evidence to the DAs to take this case or to take that case.
And election integrity can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So what kind of cases did y'all investigate? I know you started out as a criminal investigations. But what kind of cases did y'all investigate?
Well, and so it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And so sometimes I get asked, what is election fraud? Mm-hmm. Cheating in an election, bottom line. Some of the offenses I think people are more familiar with would be illegal voting. Someone who's not qualified to vote or not eligible to vote, rather, casts a ballot unlawfully. Those are typically your one-off cases, single charge, single defendant. But the ones that would get the most attention and the most headlines would be these massive vote harvesting rings that we would go after. And there's more than enough. People can look them up. But those would be teams of, I don't know, 1 to 5, maybe even more people. They would have an entire group of folks that would go out and they would target a specific area. And there was different variations of the grift, but essentially they would just fraudulently harvest ballots. They didn't care who it was from or who they were going. I mean, they would care who they were going to, the person that was paying them. And so we would send a team out and just, it would just be a lot of groundwork by a lot of really good investigators.
So I love that you're talking about election fraud because a lot of people ask us, you know, who work in at a think tank in election integrity, what are you doing to stop election fraud? And I say, well, we're not a criminal prosecution division. You know, we can't stop fraud. We can ask to improve the process, right? But we don't prosecute criminally, and fraud is a crime. So I'm glad to hear that there is a criminal investigation unit that is prosecuting fraud. Can you tell us what election fraud looks like today? Because I think following 2020, people have a lot of confusion about that.
Right. Well, I would say that something that, and here's the thing, that what election fraud looks like today is what it looked like in 1931, to be honest. And I know that there's a lot of stuff online about and in the national media about this, that, or the other. What I'll talk about is what we handled at the state level. And it's just plain old fashioned. You have someone who can register to vote. You go out there and there's a hundred different ways this fraud can be committed. One example that I thought was the most fascinating, because it's one of the hardest ones to catch, is someone wants an assistant. Someone wants someone to help them with their ballot. The harvester goes out there and says, who do you want to vote for? Do you want to vote for candidate A or B for governor? I want to vote for candidate A. Okay, cool. They mark that. Okay, but down that ballot, there's going to be 20 other races. And that's where you're going to have stuff where you have this harvester. That's a blank check. Everybody who's paid them, they'll get it. And then some of the more interesting cases were the ones where we would see a text of, I've got 200 ballots that I want to sell to so-and-so. And this person already came with the ballots. Like, hey, I could sell them to you. What does that mean? It'd be a whole package deal. Like, this is something I think a lot of people don't understand, is that some of the vote harvesters that are out there, especially in South Texas, they've been doing it for 20 years. I mean, I think NPR did an article on one that she was pretty much open about it. And so they've got their systems in place. They've got their connections in place. And every election, they just go out and pull those threads. But those, the vote harvesting ones, I think, are the ones that are the biggest contention. And that happens within our own system.
Okay. In addition to vote harvesting, are there any other examples that you can give us that you saw while you were investigating this?
Yeah, I would say that, you could get into the weeds on it. Like, so vote harvesting would essentially involve mail ballots.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing, I've seen a couple of different situations. We had a case or an allegation where an individual, it was a school board election, I think. And essentially one of the witnesses that were afraid to come forward were saying, you know, that some of the poll watchers were looking over their shoulders, making sure they voted for the right person. We've seen, we've seen curbside voting where they've gone out and offered cigarettes and money. And, you know, they'll bring in 5 to 10 people at a time and then drop them back off. We've seen, I think there was even a spate at one point in Texas, and I won't call them out here, but essentially someone on the radio had said that certain people could vote only in local elections. Okay, but what is that? We had a lot of separate individuals essentially voting illegally, because you had this radio ad saying they could vote in local elections, and then you had somehow someone sent them registration forms. And I remember one defendant saying, I thought I was supposed to fill it out. It landed on my doorstep. I mean, there's 100 different variations of how this usually goes down.
Right. And can you give us an idea of how widespread these allegations of voter fraud are?
See, that's one of those things, and I'm glad you used the word allegations, because, you know, from the media, a lot of the stories that you might read about how widespread is voter fraud, one of the words that they always use is prosecutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and obviously you've touched on that. Well, you're not going to have prosecutions if you don't have prosecutors. With allegations, you know, back whenever I was there, we would get allegations every single election across the four corners of Texas. You know, and then what makes that go from an allegation to a case is whether or not you put the legwork in, you take a look at it. And then even still, even before Stevens, we still strove to engage with the DAs, the local DAs, to say, hey, is this the kind of case that you want? Just because we were short on staff. We didn't have the manpower to pursue every single allegation. But I would say it's a lot more common than a lot of people give it credit for. And I'd say it's very dangerous.
So I'm just searching for an idea here, but every election cycle, how many cases would get referred to you? Are we talking 10, 20, 50? Do you recall off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I don't recall, but mm-hmm. let me add into that. So we might get an accusation from one county, okay? Mm-hmm. Simple accusation. For example, I think the election administrator said they had 1,400, or this might have come from someone else, but the election administrator essentially told us they had 1,400 applications for ballot by mail come through a single fax machine. Well, that's odd. They all came through their one fax machine, but it all came from a single address. Okay. Whenever you peel back the layers, what you might find is that this entire it was an organization consisting of 5 to 6 people, and then in that case, they were actually working ironically for $10 an hour, 8 hours a day, for 10 weeks. So now we've got 5 to 6 defendants, and then you go into each individual voter. With a big organization or a big operation, you're going to have fraud at the registration level. at the application for ballot by mail, you're going to have fraud and forgery. With voting, you're going to have fraud. And then Texas has made it a crime to where you can't transport a ballot without the voter's consent. And so one allegation can easily turn into 200 counts. But during each election cycle, I mean, I think it probably, the allegations that would come through, I think we had the Texas election integrity system that was up for a little bit. I don't know if it still is or not, but we would get, I mean, it would just be too many to count. We would action what we could, and we would try to, you know, get with the DAs on what we couldn't.
Yeah. So too many allegations of fraud to be even able to take action on all of them. That's incredible.
That is, and that right there, that's not, I mean, you know, and I've said it, I've written about it in my articles, is that there was only 3 to 5 of us total. Mm-hmm. And, you know, resource allocation is a big deal because one of these cases could go 2 years and, you know, you might have a first chair, second chair, but oftentimes we had someone who was the first chair on one case and your second chair on the other case. You know, I mean, we're just trying to make it work.
So tell us a little bit about prosecuting these cases. What is it like to prepare for a case, a voter fraud case? And then what is it like to go to court on something like this?
It's complicated. One thing that I noticed at election fraud that was different from my previous occupation. I was an Army prosecutor, prior to coming to the Attorney General's office. And some of the rulings that we would get from judges in our cases would be completely different than stuff that you might see in a normal criminal case. So, you know, on the benign scale or, you know, on the lesser, it would be, you might have a judge continue a case because he doesn't want to interfere in an election. Okay, well, continuances happen all the time. That one's not something that's super problematic. You know, it happens in election cases, doesn't happen anywhere else.
And for the non-lawyers, continuing a case just means pushing it down the road a little bit.
That's right.
In this case, so that it's past an election.
That's right. But one of the more complicated issues is, what if you have a judge who's been accused of election fraud? Okay, because that has happened. Okay, so now the district attorney, who knows the judge, he's conflicted out. The judge, or all the judge who would be hearing the case, he's also conflicted out. And I think a lot of people don't understand that in smaller counties, it's a tight community. You know, I'm from a small town in East Texas. You know, you see the same people every day on the opposite side or on the same table. So conflicts of interest would pop up, and then there's nobody to handle this case. And so we would have situations where we're scrambling to try to find a visiting judge, someone to hear it. And then for some reason, whenever politics got brought into a criminal proceeding, you'd have accusations of political bias, politics, whatever have you, that wouldn't have anything to do with the facts.
That sounds a lot like the national election cases that are going on, right? Allegations of political bias and everything else. It happens at all levels. So tell us, one thing that people are concerned about is that more election fraud cases are not prosecuted. Why are there not more cases prosecuted in Texas?
I would say, and you know, first and foremost, State v. Stevens. I'd be remiss.
And tell us about that. Give us a summary of that case, please.
So Zena Collins Stevens was a sheriff's deputy, I think in Chambers County, maybe somewhere else. She was a sheriff. She wasn't a deputy. And essentially, the FBI was conducting an investigation to someone else. They uncovered the fact that Zena Collins Stevens had, you know, accepted campaign contributions unlawfully. There was an election fraud nexus. They took it to the local DA. Obviously, the local DA didn't take the case. I don't know what the reason is, but could be because he's the district attorney, she's the sheriff. He told them to take it to the Rangers, and long story short, the Rangers presented it to the Texas Attorney General's office. They filed eventually became a writ of habeas corpus, essentially arguing that the Texas Attorney General did not have constitutional authority to prosecute. One was a penal code violation, tampering with a government record, and, you know, to prosecute any crimes under the Texas election code, because it was a criminal offense. This went to the first, I believe it's the first court of appeals in Houston, They concluded, no, this is fine. AG can take the case. It went to the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is Texas's high court, as you know. We have split sort of courts, Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. And the Court of Criminal Appeals concluded an 8-1 decision with only Judge Yeary dissenting that the Texas Attorney General did not have authority to prosecute election integrity under 273.021. And then the proverbial wheels came off the train. That would be what took us out. I would say
us meaning the Attorney General's office.
Yes, sir.
Right. So the result of that ruling was that the Attorney General's office cannot prosecute those types of cases.
Not without the request of a district attorney. But this is where, and I want to mention this, this is where it gets really complicated. The court wasn't exactly specific on what a request might look like. And the reason why I take issue with that is because I had a case where I didn't have the request of an attorney or district attorney, where I also did. And let me go into detail with that. Normally, for the Criminal Prosecutions Division at the Attorney General's office, they have to be, they'll typically be appointed pro tem. There's a conflict. The district attorney files a motion to appoint attorney pro tem. And this isn't a hard and fast rule. There's other limited exemptions, but the district court will grant that motion and will appoint the Attorney General's office. But it's at the request of a district attorney. But one thing I don't think that was considered in the Stevens decision is, what if the district attorney calls you and then he says, hey, if I recuse my office, this judge is going to accuse me of stepping aside and letting him be prosecuted, you know? And so I think that, you know, I mean, obviously that's hard to put into a brief, but you'd be surprised at how often that happens. I mean, at a local level,
right,
there's no difference between me recusing myself versus me prosecuting the case, at least on a personal level.
Right. So that explains a lot as to why Ken Paxton, who is a great leader for the rule of law, the Texas Attorney General, has not done more prosecutions on election integrity issues. Why don't you think we see more prosecutions at the local level, though, in district attorney's offices?
Well, I think, here's the thing, district attorneys, especially the ones in Texas, we should be very proud of. They're hardworking individuals. A lot of them are very hardworking. They're of the community. That's the thing. They're slammed. You know, I mean, you've got your standard bread and butter cases. You're going to have white collar crime, fraud, theft, assault, murder, sexual assault. To go up to a district attorney, which I know this because I've done it, and be like, hey, by the way, in addition to everything you've got with your 1 to 2 to 11 person office, we're going to give you a massive conspiracy involving 5 people and upwards of 250 counts. Do you think you're ready for it? No, I think you guys know how to take it, you know? And then, you know, so part of that is out personnel. We're more than happy to take the case. And if any district attorneys are struggling with one of these, please, you know, by all means. But part of that too is the expertise. And I don't know why it was difficult for some other people, but the election fraud cases have two codes, the penal code and the election code. And for some reason that just kind of crosses wires along the way. So, you know, you have some DAs that, like I said, are overworked. You have some that don't feel like they have the expertise, but, you know, and I hate to say it, you're going to a district attorney who's an elected official and you're saying, hey, we want you to prosecute this issue that came out of an election that you won. How do you feel about that? It's awkward for everybody in the room. So those are just some of the factors.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And you've done a lot to kind of alleviate or to answer questions about the lack of election fraud prosecutions. And this is so important because, you know, the narrative in the national media is that election fraud doesn't exist. But here you are as an assistant attorney general for the state of Texas telling us that there was a whole division dedicated to prosecuting election fraud and investigating election fraud. And regardless of whether the convictions happen, the fraud exists. You've seen it in your professional capacity.
100%. Like I said, you know, I think it's been said by other people, but you're not going to find what you don't look for. And again, the Texas Attorney General's office, regardless of Stevens, we have a whole team that investigates and assists district attorneys with this. Our guys are out there looking at it every day with every resource they have.
So this is interesting. And just I'd like to reiterate also that the Heritage Foundation has an election fraud database with, I think, over 1,300 or approaching 1,400 documented cases of election fraud. And I think to get mentioned in that database, you have to have been, there has to have been a conviction fraud. So fraud is definitely out there. So let's look forward a little bit. You know, you spend a lot of time investigating election fraud. Going into the 2024 election, what should we be on the lookout for? What are the types of fraud that we might see?
I think this is something that I've been asked in my travels. You know, how do I protect myself from election fraud? I would say, well, and I mean that on an individual level and on a larger level, I would say that we need people watching the election administrator's offices. And I say that, you know, legally, politely, you know, but that's really where it comes down. I mean, election administrators during election season, they're swamped just like anybody else. There's a lot of rules that sometimes go off to the wayside where they may not notice. Something may come through and they may be like, I don't know what to do with that. But we also, the other thing too, is that I have talked to more than one election administrator and I've asked them hard questions. Like, what do you do whenever a truck full of six people pull up? How do you keep the ballot anonymous whenever you have five people in there voting at curbside voting? And they're like, well, you know, we just do the best we can, which is a non-answer. The other thing I've asked is how do you verify signatures? Well, we err on the side of accepting the vote because we don't want to alienate a voter. Okay, well that's not going to do much. You really need to look at these things because that's how we catch a lot of these cases. I would say on a policy level, you know, be respectful, be polite. But just make sure the election administrators are following the law, following processes. If you see something, say something, call it in. If you see someone there, I cannot think of any instances off the top of my head where anyone stuffing ballots into a drop box has ever been a kosher sanctioned activity. So if you see someone out there doing that, please, you know, call the Secretary of State, call the Attorney General's office. And also something that I think that hasn't been discussed a lot is that a lot of these local communities, they know who the politicaris are. And if you are out there right now and you're so tired of, you know, nothing that you want ever gets done, and you know that this person harvests votes or they've asked you to harvest, then call it in.
And just so that everybody's clear, a politicaro is one of these ballot traffickers that you've been talking about.
Yeah, I apologize for using an unusual term. I hope it catches on because I love it. But a politicaro...
It originates in South Texas, right?
It does. It actually originates in South Texas. That's where we got it from. And it was so much... It's much fewer syllables than vote harvester, you know? So we stuck with it. But that's essentially it. A politicaro could be, a vote harvester, a vote trafficker, they oftentimes on campaign finance reports, if there is even a financial record of them being paid, they'll be a consultant. So no offense to any consultants out there. I'm just saying it's a wide pool. But exactly, that's what a politicaro would be. And they are well known and they are almost a tradition in some places.
That's interesting. So then I've got to ask, if these politicaros are so well known, is it just a lack of prosecutorial resources that keep people from going after them, or are they so ingrained culturally in certain parts of the state that people just don't see a need?
You know, that's an interesting question. I can say that there are some places in Texas, and if anybody can feel free to fact check me on, I've seen dueling politicaras before. I've seen, you know, politicaras bashing each other through text about so-and-so didn't get this, so-and-so didn't get that. One thing that is interesting, though, and I was surprised to see it, is, and I don't know what to make of it, is whenever you talk to a district attorney and you're like, yeah, this person harvests votes. Oh, we know about them. Okay. What do you mean you know about them? And then, you know, it would come with a disclaimer like, I never used them. Trust me. And, okay, that's fine. I don't know. And I don't want to impugn the integrity of anybody. I mean, if they're there, I just, to me, it doesn't make any sense. Why not just tee it up and make sure your elections are free and fair? And on that note, one thing I would say is, you know, if you're in office and you're comfortable, but you know there's a politicaro out there, how long do you think until somebody decides to pay them to run you out? Now is probably the time to handle that issue.
That's a really good point. We don't want to have to go there, but maybe there's a political incentive. to go after these ballot traffickers.
That's right.
Huh. So let me ask you this, Levi. What are some of the wildest stories you've heard about ballot trafficking, election fraud, whatever it is in Texas? Tell us some things that might surprise the listeners.
I hope I can make a typically dry topic interesting here. I'll go into a couple and hopefully they're interesting. One of my favorite victims of, and you know, I say this in a weird lawyer way, one of the most interesting victims of ballot harvesting that I've ever dealt with was an individual. He was in a type A or type B nursing home, which is essentially he was unable to care for himself due to his mental acuity. So my investigators told me, I was like, I need you to go out there to interview him, please. And they went to interview him. They came back and they're like, this guy thinks it's 1977. He thinks he's dating Farrah Fawcett. And I was like, you know, I thought they were ribbing me. I was like, wait, are you sure? And nope. Other investigator comes up, goes, yep, it's 1977. Okay. All right. Right on. Okay. So we can conclude that he probably did not mean to vote or did not vote or didn't fill out his ballot. Yeah, that'd be a reasonable assumption. Okay, well, then we asked the caregiver, the nurse. They had a traveling nurse. And my investigators, we talked to her, and she was like, oh, no, these people cannot vote. They're not aware of their surroundings. And, you know, and anyway, she was promptly terminated right after that. And then where it gets weirder was his brother. This individual's brother was a licensed psychologist in Canada. We called him and he was like, do what? What happened? You know, I mean, it was, and so, you know, and that would be one. The other one, I mean.
And just really quick, Levi, before you go on, unfortunately, that happens way too often.
Oh, yes.
People taking advantage of vulnerable voters in all ways. And we just hate to hear stories like that, but that's wild.
Well, it's wild because he was one of over a dozen. Oh. I mean, this whole, you know. One thing we've seen that's kind of odd is if you have an assisted living facility or nursing home, you might have someone who runs that nursing home and the Politicara will just go to them and pay them money and then they'll go and pick up the ballots later. And I think that's
terrible.
Here's something though that I think a lot of people don't know. And this is something that I hope gets around because, you know, Texas takes a lot of pride in the laws that we pass to ensure the safety and security of our elections. What people don't know is that a lot of Politicaras, a lot of harvesters, they go to trainings for deputy voter registrars. I don't think anybody has really talked about that, but I've seen a couple of cases where they were like, oh yeah, so-and-so popped in here and they asked us a bunch of weird questions. And my point is whenever a law comes out, they're gonna figure out how to get around it. And one thing I wanna bring up, and this is the first time, I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, I think with SB1, there was the 4 digits on the application for ballot by mail, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I've already seen a case, or I saw a case prior to leaving election fraud, where we had a Politicara that had been very experienced in harvesting. Well, she's submitting ballots for the opposing party that didn't have the 4 numbers. She would have known better because the ballots for her party had the 4 numbers. And then the only thing I can deduce from that is she saw this. That was a big issue. That was a very big issue. She saw it. She was like, okay, so if somebody doesn't vote the way I want them to vote and I can't modify our ballot, which she could, she was steaming open ballots, then I'll I just want to include these 4 numbers and they'll get basically spoiled, you know? And I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was very clever. And it's funny because I don't think that everybody's going home thinking, wow, that law fixed it. No.
Right. Incredible. Just incredible. Huh. All right, Levi, you've been incredibly generous with your time. So tell us as we wrap up here, what can we do to protect against voter fraud?
The we is a large tent. I think step one, I think the Attorney General needs to get the authority back to prosecute voter fraud. And the reason why it's not just to ensure it's not just to fix the problem, but it's to help out the local DAs who are struggling. We need to have that authority back. But the other thing too is, you know, do some reading on it. I mean, look up the history because this new narrative that election fraud doesn't exist. I mean, this is Texas. Lyndon B. Johnson in Box 13. I mean, that's nothing new. Tammany Hall in New York. I mean, the idea that this crime all of a sudden hasn't become a tradition in politics is absurd. So I would encourage people to get smart on it. Get smart on it. Keep an open eye out. And because all we want, Democrat, Republican, middle, left, right, whatever it is, we just want to have a free system where we can elect the people we want to be in charge.
Thanks, Levi. Levi Fuller, Assistant Attorney General with the state of Texas, talking about voter fraud and dispelling the myth that voter fraud does not exist anymore. Thank you for your time, Levi.
Thank you.
This is Josh Findlay with the Texas Public Policy Foundation's National Election Protection Project. Thanks for joining us.